All right. It's a good morning to you and welcome to Realm of the Historics. And today we look at all the burning stars that is about to fall, in the South Asian peninsula, if you like. So good morning and prepare yourself. Let's be together. All right, we are on, and we just want to investigate what is going on. You know, it seems that the world is about to blow up again. And this blowing up is going to be the blowing up of the blowing up. But this blowing up is in fact not new. It's an old blow up. But maybe this time it's going to blow up in a world of cutting technology. And the ones that have the best, the one that will have the best technology will win whatever it is that is going to erupt. Now, there is conflict that is about to erupt between Pakistan and India. And most of you have followed that way. There are around 26 Hindu tourists were killed in the Kashmir area. That is the Indian-controlled Kashmir side. And that was, of course, last week. And that also prompted the exchange between the Pakistani and Indian forces in that, you know, Kashmir Peninsula. And it is said that India is amassing forces. And India is preparing, they are doing air drills and, you know, they are doing rehearsals. The Indian Air Force is doing rehearsals, having their own, you know, Su-30 aircraft and so forth, and refuel jets, you know. And it seems that India is prepared for war. And there was a treaty that India is suspending, that is the Indo-Water treaty between India and Pakistan. And Pakistan has warned that should India go ahead with the suspension or the calling of the treaty, it will treat it as an act of war. So it is going to be war. So we are seeing what is about to brew. The United States is tired of the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. They want to end the war because they have other things to attend to. They have other matters, but it seems that Zelensky doesn't want to end the war. So it becomes a problem. Zelensky has become sort of a thorn in the flesh to the United States. And now they are saying it is easy to deal with Putin than to deal with Zelensky. So it is very easy to deal with Putin than to deal with Zelensky. That is what the US, United States officials are saying. Now, there was also, last week, of course, there was at the burial of, you know, the Pope, you know that the Pope is deceased. At the burial of the Pope, Macron wanted to meet because there was a meeting on the side. There was a meeting on the side between the U.S. and, you know, the U.S. and Ukraine, between Donald Trump and you know, Zelensky, and then, you know, there was a third chair in the room, which was supposedly, you know, to be that of Emmanuel Macron. But at the end, Emmanuel Macron was told to not, was told that he was not part of the meeting. Trump was not interested in being, in hosting Macron, or in Macron joining the meeting rather. So said, please excuse us. So those are the two stories we are going to look at, and we just want to understand what is the meaning of all, you know, we are hearing. Now, starting with India and Pakistan, India and Pakistan have been locked in battles over the state of Crimea, which each of them calls their own. The Indian says Kashmir is theirs. The Pakistanis say Kashmir is theirs. Just like, you know, the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea that took decades. So, it is very hard to tell, just like, you know, between Azerbaijan and Armenia. They were fighting for this province, Nagorno-Karabakh. You remember the Nagorno-Karabakh? In 2020, there was, you know, a fight between Azerbaijan and Armenia over the Nagorno-Karabakh, which Armenia says it's theirs and Azerbaijan says this is ours. And do you know that Pakistan was part of India? And they just, you know, separated because they separated on religious ground. Because Pakistan became predominantly Muslim or Islamic. And then India remained to be predominantly Hindu. Okay, so if there is a fully blown conflict between India and Pakistan, you need to understand that these are nuclear armed nations. And Pakistan is the only Islamic country that has nuclear weapons. They have around 30 or 40 nuclear warheads. And maybe India also has some, around 80 nuclear warheads, if I'm not mistaken. They are not many, but they are nuclear warheads. And most people are afraid of the possibility of some nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan. And India and Pakistan will draw the world into division. They will divide the world. The world will be divided because of Pakistan and India. Some countries will take India's side, and others will take Pakistan's side. And it is going to be the game of chess between major powers. It could be between China and the United States, or China, Russia, and the United States, whichever country chooses to take sides. Don't also forget that Israel has also bombed, you know, Syria because of what, you know, how Syria apparently is mistreating the minority groups. So it's a plate of chili soup, if you like, what is about to manifold. It's a plate of chili sauce. Very hot. And it's a powers. It's up to the powers to decide whether they want to go nuclear or they will just go conventional. But between Pakistan and India, whichever country will be defeated on a conventional battlefield might opt to use some nuclear, you know, ammunitions or some nuclear munition. Okay, so here are some speculations. You know, we need to get into some speculation here. Some experts are saying India is receiving a lot of artificial intelligence support and cutting-edge technology from Israel. And, of course, India is also buying a lot of aircraft and missiles, a lot of new fleet of aircrafts is being bought because India is mobilizing full force. And some people are saying that India will take territory this time. So India will take territory this time. And will Pakistan allow it to happen? Certainly not. Pakistan will fight back. And their foreign minister has already said, their defense minister has already said that Pakistan will respond in an in-kind to India's aggression. That brings us to, I know that most of us, when we talk about war, we want to hear who is a winner, who is going to be the winner. Well, I'm not sure who is going to be the winner between Pakistan and India. But let's do some calculation. And let's do some calculation and find out. India is 1.4 billion people. And Pakistan is around 100 and maybe 60 or 40 million people. So when it comes to mobilization, depending on the available resources, India is able to mobilize twice the population of Pakistan. So Pakistan can be outnumbered by Indian troops. The Pakistan troops can be outnumbered. And we don't know the technological prowess and capacity of Pakistan, but you know too well that India is one of the countries that are technologically advanced, at least. So Pakistan might be out-technologied, if there's such a word. Pakistan might be out-technologied. And India might have, India also, the Indian economy is a third in the world, according to last year's IMF report, that India is a third in the world in terms of purchase power parity. So, and Pakistan is not even in the list of the top 10 countries that are rich in the world. So their economy is quite smaller. And they might not be able to sustain a protracted war with a major power like India. Major power in many ways. major power economically, major power militarily, major power in terms of population and technology. Therefore, when we look at all that, one might say that, okay, Pakistan will be at a disadvantageous, you know, place here. So Pakistan will be at a disadvantageous position here. But you never know, because America went to fight Vietnam. And it does not always mean that because you are a major power, you can always win. We are yet to see that. But when we look at the realities on the ground, those are the realities. That when it comes to India, India is 1.4 billion. Pakistan is just 100 and something million. And India is able to mobilize 200 million. An army of 200 million, depending on the resources that they might have. So, you don't play with numbers. They are able to mobilize an army of 200 million, then they are able to crush Pakistan. But maybe Pakistan is not going to be alone. It's going to be to have other Islamic, you know, other Arab world countries that are also going to fight on alongside Pakistan against India. What if the West join India and to support India for, you know, to support India? And what if China joins Pakistan to support Pakistan against the West? Well, other speculators are saying that Israel is supporting India. And in fact, they have transferred some of the tanks and rifles that they were using in Gaza. They are now transferring some of the technologies that they have to assist India. Some of the, you know, cutting-edge technology, military systems. They are sending those to India, according to some speculators, according to some military experts. That's what some certain military experts are busy speculating. And I'm using the word speculation here because you have to take this with a large grain of salt. Don't use sugar. Use salt. What are they fighting for? India says Pakistan supports terrorism. And in fact, the US also said, the US Trump said, Pakistan must stop supporting terrorism. So you see, it's a hinge already that the United States might support India at this time. Pakistan has been the United States ally when they were fighting when they were fighting against the Taliban in Afghanistan. The United States worked together with Pakistan when Pakistan was under Pervez Musharraf. Pervez Musharraf was kind of like an ally to the United States. He was kind of like an ally to the United States. But now, cards may shift, and if this happens, you know, if a full blown war, you know, erupts between India and Pakistan, there is no doubt about countries choosing sides. And this will be one of the long wars and one of the most complicated wars. And there'll be high casualties on both sides. Right. So in 2021, there was a conflict where the Indian jets, you know, bombed, or the Pakistani jets bombed India, and India fired back. So there's been some of those exchange between India. And in 1999, there was also a short war between India and Pakistan again. And in around 2000, you were fighting over, you know, Kashmir again. And luckily, they did not use nuclear weapons. So, who knows? They might use nuclear weapon this time. And it is not going to be something anybody will enjoy, because nuclear weapons, those are weapons that are very destructive. Because countries with nuclear weapons, that's why they have nuclear weapons, is because it's to protect them from being conventionally defeated, or from being defeated on a conventional battlefield. That's why they have nuclear weapons. That whenever we see that we are not performing better on the battlefield and the enemy is advancing towards taking our territory, we use nuclear to wipe out the advancing army. And that's why there has never been war between nuclear armed countries. That is what everyone is afraid of. We are going to take a short musical break, and we'll be right back to continue. So, why does Israel want to be interested in supporting India over Pakistan? You know, but this is not, like I said, you need to take this by, you know, with a pinch of, or a grain of salt, a very large grain of salt, because this is just speculations. These are just speculations from, of course, the renowned military experts. Most of them are speculating that Israel is supporting India to kind of crush Pakistan. And now, why is India, or why is Israel interested in supporting India over Pakistan? The answer is very simple. Because Israel is locked in a battle that's historic. And it seems that Israel is fighting the entire Arab world, the entire Islamic world. They are fighting Israel. Or Israel is fighting them. And this is a hatred between the Jews and the Arabs, which has become political, and it has become religious. So, and no country was able to solve it. You know, the Americans could not solve it in as much as they are powerful. The Russians could not either. The Chinese could not. So all the major powers, including the United Nations, could not bring peace in the Middle East. So you have 21 countries in the Middle East, the majority of which apparently are against Israel, and they want Israel wiped out of the world map. And that's why Israel acquired nuclear weapons to defend itself and its existence. Whether those are true and factual things or not, or sayings or not, let it be up to you to find ground in any of that. But we say, why? Why is Israel supporting India? The answer is very simple, because Pakistan is an Arab country, it's an Islamic country, and they have the same ideology apparently against the Jewish state of Israel. Therefore, Israel will take any side of anybody fighting any of those countries. And of course, the United States will automatically support India. And this is now will put into question, will Russia support in Pakistan, and what type of support will Russia give to Pakistan? Well, it's very less likely this time for Russia to intervene militarily in Pakistan or Pakistan, because Russia is also locked up into Ukraine. And I think if a major war, you know, starts between Israel, between India and Pakistan, the world will divert from Ukraine into the Indian conflict. And that will give the Russians more time to crush Ukraine and, in fact, maybe take more territories. And I think the Russians are praying for that. And it is, I think, in the advantage of Zelensky to end the war right now, because should any war start between any country, the world will divert from him into the new war. And therefore, it will be, the support Zelensky will get will be very little. So the Zelensky will get little support, because most countries will now, you know, amass resources for the new war. And that would just mean something, would just mean one thing on Ukraine, capitulation. So it's better for Ukraine to negotiate peace now than later. We'll find that one. But it seems that the European Union and European countries don't want the peace. And that's why Trump, you know, kind of embarrassed Emmanuel Macron, because Emmanuel Macron is, you know, is a powerhouse. He's a military powerhouse of, military powerhouse in Europe. There are three powers in Europe. So United Kingdom is a money hub. You know, it's a pocket of Europe. And then Germany was the industrial powerhouse of Europe. And then France was the military powerhouse. You know? So it was Britain, Germany, and France. Those were the powerful countries, or other powerful countries in Europe. And they feel like Ukraine cannot negotiate war, cannot negotiate without them. They feel like they are also powers. They must be also included. And that's why Macron wanted to sit in the meeting with Zelensky and Trump, kind of like to, you know, to control the meeting. But Trump said, nope, I'm not interested in meeting Macron. I want to talk to Zelensky alone. Please, Macron, can you excuse us? Because what France wants Russia to be defeated. Because of what Russia orchestrated, the loss of French influence in certain countries of West Africa. In Burkina Faso, in Niger, in Mali, and now Algeria. So, a lot of, you know, countries in a lot of countries that were under, you know, French rule are kind of revolting against French rule supported by Russia. And, you know, France doesn't want that. France wants Russia crushed. But the truth is that they are not able to mobilize resources to fight the Russians on their own without the United States arm. But the United States have said they are no longer interested in supporting Ukraine and also in the continuity of the war. They want the war to end because they have other things to do. That is according to Marco Rubio, who is the Secretary of State of the United States, and also J.D. Vance, who is the Vice President. They have other things to do. And Ukraine war is senseless, according to Trump. It's a senseless war. You shouldn't have started it. Now, Trump is saying it to Europe, is also saying it to Zelensky. You shouldn't have started this war. You cannot fight against a country that is 20 times powerful than, you know, 20 times more powerful than you, and expect to win. And you want to depend on aid, like on aids, on weaponry, assistance. It doesn't work. Those are all words of Trump, you know, trying to rebuke Zelensky. But Zelensky has been, you know, made to get used to being pampered. You know, when you pamper a child and you make the child used, you make a child used to pampering, when you start to change, that child may not understand. Because this child is used to pampering. This child will resort to manipulative tactics for him to win or for her to win. But, well, Trump is saying, nope, we are no longer going to give you weapons. If you don't want to end the war, you are going to fight the war alone. Or if the Russians don't want to end the war, we are going to increase sanctions. But the Russians have been ready for the sanctions. And there'll be no other sanctions there'll be no more sanctions that are worse than what the Russians have gone through, and they've overcome all that. Now we are going to find that out. But we now go back to India. India, India is a major power. Not as major as China, or as major as United States, or as major as Russia, but India is a major power. Major in 3 to 4 ways. Major, number one, in economy. Economically speaking, India is major. It's a major power compared to Pakistan. Militarily speaking, India is a major power. Technologically speaking, India is a major power. So those are three. And also populations, you know, population-wise, India is also a major power. So, I would say that India, Pakistan is outnumbered already. You know, before this war starts, Pakistan is already outnumbered. But maybe there's something else that Pakistan has that can turn the tide. But otherwise, fairly speaking, Pakistan is already outnumbered. And if the war breaks out between the two nations, we will be at the mercy of who is going to decide what. Of course, maybe they will wipe each other up there and will not be part of the nuclear winter, because this is going to be very far from us. But who knows that it will not escalate into major powers fighting each other, that will result into World War III. And no one can win the war. Yes. Hello? Hello? All right. We cannot hear. All right. So do call back if you want to be part of the conversation. The number in studio is 083-2888-401. we'll be able to have a conversation. If you are interested in the conversation.
Different genre of music in Jamaica. We have the first, it was the Mentor. Then it became ska. Then it moved to rock steady. Then it moved to reggae. And now it's dancehall. But the most popular and most influential one of those genres is reggae music. And that is why we are here today. That is why the festival is called Reggae Sundance Festival. So, we're going to bring artists who rose up in the reggae. And we're going to tell you that he's called Luciano. Luciano.
Face this ugly life with gruesome fire struggles to get to by. My friends and my environment sometimes they don't be wrong, but by my faith I keep holding on. Are you ready? Tell us to let never down. Tell your potential. Greetings are gone by. Are so confused, they don't know what to do. They fuss and fight for what they think is right. Life for them seems so hard, they don't know where to turn. When lessons that they need to learn. Thank you.
Okay, but one thing we also need to know is that war is very expensive, and war is for two people. It's for two leaders, the one that becomes victorious and the other one that becomes a loser. And everyone else is collateral. Okay, we speak as if we have forgotten that today is the 4th of, you know, May, when in 1978, almost, you know, 47 years ago, the Kasinga camp, that's a refugee camp according to SWAPO, was attacked, and up to 600 people were killed, if these numbers are correct. Now, no one held South Africa responsible. No one sanctioned South Africa for the massacre. In fact, South Africa did not even pay reparation to the victims of Kasinga, even to the survivors and those who lost their loved ones to this tragic event. South Africa did not pay any money. We also know that almost 100, we can say 120 years ago, the first genocide was committed in here, in Namibia, especially in these regions of Komasi, in these southern regions. Up to 100,000 people were killed. Women, men, and children slaughtered by, you know, the colonial maniac, called von Trotta von Bismarck. I mean, Otto von Bismarck was that time, he was a chancellor. An emperor, whatever they call himself, they call him. I think that time, yeah. So, and Germany never paid anything. Because he has committed a crime over a weak nation who doesn't have a strong hand to support them get justice. So war is not something that one can play with, or one can just do. It's not a walk in the park. War has three people: one victor, one victorious, one is a loser. And one or two is a profiteer from that war. So I don't know what type of resources Pakistan has, But if Pakistan has oil and war breaks out, some powers will come in and find, you know, a loophole to be taking oil. Just like what happens in Syria and in Libya. The Turkish are there in Libya. The United States of America is there. France is there. Russia is there. China is there, I think. They are taking oil. While the Libyan people are fighting, they are fighting for power and control, and Libya has just become a den of chaos. Libya was one of the food baskets of Africa, one of the vibrant economy. I mean, it was once a vibrant economy. But today, Libya is a den of all sorts of chaos. It's a transit area for human trafficking. But that was, of course, the Obama and NATO project. You don't even need to talk, you don't even want to talk about what Iraq has become. Iraq does not exist as a country. You know, Iraq is chaotic. That was, you know, George Bush Jr. and the NATO project. So if Pakistan should be defeated, it will. We cannot afford Pakistan to be defeated. In fact, India cannot even afford a broken state of Pakistan. Because India will not cope with an influx of people that will move from Pakistan into India or into neighboring countries like Afghanistan, Iran, and so forth. So a broken state of Pakistan will just mean one thing, a den of chaos. It will join Iraq, it will join Syria, it will join Libya, it will join Lebanon. And the list will go on. It will join Yemen. So that's the consequences. Those are the consequences of war. When war comes, the state ceases to exist. And when the state ceases to exist, everybody does what they want. There will be no law. It becomes lawlessness. People start looting. The police do not exist. There's no court to take anybody to before any justice. There's no state. The vulnerable are thrown to the dogs. And it's a survival of the fittest. And it becomes a jihadi kind of environment where you have to fight to survive. And that's most of these, you know, former Islamic countries have become. You know, because they become dens of chaos, because these countries were in order. Iraq was very much in order, you know, during Saddam Hussein. Libya was very much in order during, Gaddafi. But now, Libya, Iraq, Syria was better off when Assad was in power. Now, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, they are now dens of chaos, of course, with Libya. Can we afford another country again to follow suit? Then that means that most countries, most of these people will flee to, for example, Europe, And then cause chaos there. So it's a tragic situation the world finds itself. Very challenging situation. And no one can afford any war, especially between the major powers. Yes.
Franz, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? Long time.
Yes.
Yes. Who brought the chaos?
You tell me.
If those countries like Iraq and Libya and many other countries that you have not mentioned, who brought the chaos? Maybe somebody with due influence brought that confusion. And perhaps they want to take advantage. I understand the battle that is going on there. So, but then, who is actually the source of all this, the roots, the confusion? Especially in Libya and Iraq. If there was order. So there was, you know, this order there. So within the society. Maybe those ones, we need to root them out too, because you have mentioned that it's also very difficult to mediate between those religious conflicts, you know, those roots. And I believe people can still negotiate, mediate for the peace. Even if the other efforts have failed, maybe in the past, and those powerful people, maybe the power that they were using is not that much of the one that creates more peace, harmony. So that who is now bringing the chaos? And then maybe we start from there so that we can see how, whether we can reach some kind of consensus to have peace. Friends.
Uncle Bana, you are asking who is bringing the chaos. I thought you were answering the question.
Yes, because for me, because you did ask a question now, and I understand that maybe my answer so is that yes, the person who is bringing that confusion, perhaps I know the competition between the technology and things like that. But shouldn't it be so a perfect kind of a competition? And then the person who is bringing chaos, for me, my understanding is that if there was order before in Libya and Iraq, so the person who intervened there, who actually went there to kill the people, I think is the one who brought this chaotic order. There was also, the system was fine, administration and everything, the judicial system was fine. Now the person who has brought the chaos, like you say, Trump is not this one and this other one, Pakistan and India and all these other things. So before we even look at the population, who may have the power and things like that. So what is the source of those confusions? And where is it coming from? Maybe we need to dig there and find out what is the source of these confusions. Then can we then restore the order that was there before? If it was that, if it was in the benefits of the people and the world. Maybe it's issues of that thing. I think it's fine, France, and maybe I can just end up here.
All right, thank you very much, Uncle Bana.
Welcome, sir.
Yes, how are you hearing us?
No, I'm hearing you very well. But, you know, there is some kind of, maybe it's a break that is coming. It could be through a Malungula, a break.
You are calling from where?
Excuse me?
You are calling from where?
I'm calling from, I'm just with Kandali here. He's also listening to you.
Well, you are in Oshakati?
Yes.
Okay.
Kandali, great job.
It's a fan.
Yes.
Hablate.
Me era para nada.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, call me later, ne?
Okay.
Yes.
So, thank you very much for interrupting me into your program, Skandari.
Thank you.
God bless.
Right. Who brought the chaos? That's the question. Well, you can say, no, the Americans brought the chaos, but you see, the Americans were assisted by us. You know, the Americans come in the country, and we side them, and we overthrow our own governments, thinking that we are going to be better after the overthrow of the FA government. And now all the so-called opposition parties in those countries are nowhere to be found. The so-called human rights activists that were used. And this is one thing that you Namibians need to wake up to. You know, because you are also drinking the same wine of the so-called activism. Activism is very good. But there is what I call chaotic activism, where you are no longer an activist who is, you know, patriotic. You are just an activist, you know, just full of vigilantism. And these are the tools that foreign powers can use if they want to invade the country and destroy it. They use activists, the so-called human rights activists, the so-called human rights organizations. Those are the ones that are used. And they are funded they are given big money to push a certain narrative. And don't forget that the media also plays a role. So, a certain narrative is pushed for certain years, it's just build up, until then there is a military wing formed somewhere, and then war breaks out. Or maybe another country will come in and promise a certain politician certain power that, no, once we are done, you take over and you get money to rebuild. We are going to give you money to rebuild the country. And this sounds to be a future for people that could not win through democratic means. So, and you take the challenge. And that is what happened to Libya. The rebel leader thought he was going to be the leader after Gaddafi. But then, after Gaddafi was bombed and destroyed and killed, there was no more order. And the countries that were bombing, that were supporting with weapons, disappeared one by one. Obama disappeared. David Cameron disappeared. François Hollande disappeared. And everybody started disappearing because now they have helped you, or you have helped them, to destroy your own country. They are now disappearing and your country becomes a den of chaos. This is one thing that Africans don't think. These are things that Africans don't think about. They only think about becoming powerful. I can give you an example of Congo. When Congo became independent, there was this prime minister, very powerful, Patrice Lumumba. And Mobutu Sese Seko was used. And Patrice Lumumba died, you know, horrifically. He died horribly. And Sese Seko came to power. So, and what happened? After some years, Sesa Seko was also ousted by Lawrence Kabila. So, chaos comes when you, once the leader is out, and once a leader is out through violence, it is less likely for you to find order again. The whole country just plunges into chaos. There were fewer instances where, you know, power was seized by force and the country went into order. There are very few cases, but in most cases, when a leader is ousted, there is always chaos that follows. And so a country, we cannot afford Pakistan to be in chaos. Or we cannot afford India to be in chaos. We cannot afford India to be in chaos.
in stone with a reckless streak. Yeah, the grass never gets too grown underneath my feet. City lights, southern stars, no such thing's gone too far. I'm running wide open. I was born with my feet in motion. Since I met you, I swear I could be happy anywhere. Any map, dot, location, you're always my destination. You're the only thing that I'm chained to. I could be happy anywhere. I could be happy anywhere with you. Yeah, the beauty of the northern lights in my mind is faded. The blue sky over Telluride next to you's kinda overrated. The winding road, let it twist. My home's wherever your heart is. I'm running wide open. I was born with my feet in motion. Since I met you, I swear I could be happy anywhere.
All right, it's 21 minutes to 9, and 9 o'clock, of course, my colleague Simon will take over and we will meet again next Sunday. But what I'm trying to tell you is that war is only good for those who are selling weapons. It is not good for those that are dying and those that are losing loved ones. And in fact, somebody can say we will fight to the last person, but he is not even the last person. Because him, once he sees that things are not, you know, moving well, he can flee the country and go somewhere with his children, his wife, and, you know, enjoy himself there because he's made some investment. But it is you that is going to be that are going to be mobilized to go and fight. And you are going to fight a war that you have no idea what it is coming to achieve. The only safe thing is for those that are fighting to defend their own country. Like if a country is attacked, the soldiers that are going to fight to defend their country, that's when you are saying, okay, fine. They are defending their land. Yeah. But still, once they see that, things are not moving the way they want, they put on civilian clothes and then they disappear. They flee. and the country is plunged into chaos. And the neighboring countries, then they start to suffer. Because people start fleeing that country into those countries. And then bringing a strain, a financial strain to those countries. For example, when chaos is in Zambia, people will flee from Zambia into Namibia. And those that are at the other side, they will flee into Tanzania, some will flee into Malawi, some will flee into, you know, into Angola. Then those countries will be burdened. Just like, you know, a lot of Zimbabweans fled to South Africa. And South Africa is overburdened by millions of, you know, of Zimbabweans that are in, Zimbabwean nationals that are in South Africa. Because of the chaos that is taking place or that is going on in Zimbabwe. So you in this world, you know, you cannot afford a country to be, you cannot afford a neighboring country to be in chaos. You cannot afford a neighboring country to be in chaos. Because that means you will be the one to feed those people. They will come and look for refugee status. And they'll come with all sorts of problems. Now, Europe is crying that a lot of people from Islamic countries that are coming into Europe, those guys don't want to assimilate. And they come with their own Islamic beliefs. And they want Sharia law in independent countries, in democratic countries. They want to impose some Sharia Islamic laws. And if you are following, the Italian Prime Minister was saying, no, this is not a European culture. You know, you can't impose religion on people. You can't force people to believe in your religion. Let your religion be worth following. Let it be worthy of following. But it must not be by force. Of course, we know what Islam is all about. It's about you take it or you die. That's the Quran. You know? And it is in the Quran that you either believe, it's either you believe or you die. So, but other countries are saying, okay, other countries said before that, no, guys, let's be accommodative. Let's accommodate these people. They are human beings like us. But then other countries are saying, you see now, when we were refusing to accommodate these people, you were trying to lecture us. You see now, so countries like Hungary, countries like, especially East European countries, those ones have decided, nope, they are not going to take in anybody. You know, countries like Poland, Hungary, Macedonia. In fact, Macedonia and Hungary have built a wall that anybody from Pakistan, Syria, whatever, those countries, if they approach of those walls, it's a shoot to kill policy. But we cannot afford a world like that. But this world, a world like that, but all these things are brought about by religious, you know, fanatism, where somebody thinks that their religion is, their religions must be imposed on the others. Somebody feels that their belief must be imposed on the rest of the world. Yeah, so it becomes difficult accommodating such people. You see, the Roman Catholics did the same anyway, but then it is not written in the Bible that people must be forced to believe. There is no verse in the Bible that justifies what the Roman Catholic have done. But you see, if you look at the religions like Hindu, for example, Hinduism, Buddhism, and those guys are likely to come in, and they continue being Hindu, but they will not impose it on anyone. You know, they will not impose it on anyone. Yeah, you see, it's not wrong to preach. Also, the Bible says preach to everyone. But it is not correct to force people to believe your God, to believe in your God. I think people must have choice. There's something in missionary, you know, in missions when we used to say, preach. But where possible, use words. Which means your life is the one that's supposed to preach. Your actions must be the one that must speak louder than your words. So that's why we were told you must preach. But where necessary, use words, which means you are supposed to preach with your character, with your conduct. And people become impressed and say, look, the conducts of these people, of these refugees, are worth imitating. Not the other way around. Do not force people to believe you. And you see, that's what is bringing problem, because now there will be chaos and countries will be afraid of accommodating. Countries will be afraid of accommodating you from any other countries, because they are afraid that you might come in with for example, people from Africa. You go into Europe and you want to come and set up a shack, and there's a church already. Loud noise in the neighborhood. There was not such a noise before. Loud noise already, you are praying for. You know, you are a prophet already there. So those are the things that are making countries, you know, become reluctant to receive any other person from any country, because you guys, when you get there, you don't even want to sit in and at least learn the culture of the people. So you don't want to sit in there and learn the culture of people. You are setting up a mosque, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, it's noise. And that noise was never part of that neighborhood. And when people are trying to correct, we say, no, these people are, they are phobia. It's a xenophobia, xenophobic attack. And then the so-called human rights activists come in and they blow things out of proportion. But it's just a matter of you, because you are the one that is seeking help. You are the one that is supposed to bend and understand the cultures of these people. If I am to preach in this environment, what method should I use? What method should I use? Not West African noise. I'm saying West African noise because most of our churches are coming from West Africa. Most of the Pentecostal church or churches are coming from West Africa. Not such kind of noise. And in the Pentecostal world, the people are convinced that the more noise you make, the more likelihood God is able to hear you. So, there's such a mindset, where people are convinced that the more noise you make, the more God is able to hear you, or the faster God can hear. So you go into countries like, you know, Poland, for example, and you don't assimilate, you end up deported. There are a lot of pastors that were deported from UK, from wherever. There are a lot of people don't have problem with it. I've never heard Hindus being deported from countries. I only heard Islamic and Christians. They are the ones that are always being deported from countries. And it's not because it is xenophobia. No. It's because you guys don't want to learn. It's because of that religious fanatism. You see, that makes it very difficult for people to accommodate you and for you to accommodate others. Because in Islam, they are convinced that their religion, it's their religion or no other religion. That's what Islam that's what they are convinced to. And it's not even done out of, you know, respect of others. It is done with that contempt of other people's views. And it's the same with some Christian organizations. They come into an area with such contempt of the people in that area, and with no regard at all of the people in the area. And as a result, they face backlash. And then they think they are being persecuted for being Muslims or for being Christians. So, that's why I'm saying we cannot afford any other country to be in chaos again. Because the world is tired of us coming from our country into their country with all our sorts of chaos. Because we go into countries with so much contempt and disregard of others. And no country, even in the so-called free world, no country, I know that Britain and France are regretting now. Because Britain and France were at the helm of this, you know, lecturing everyone to accommodate everyone, thinking that they are upholding the free value and human right values. They didn't know that they are putting themselves into chaos. And they are regretting now. So countries like Hungary and Poland said, nope, we are keeping our society. We don't want to mix with any other cultures. We don't want problems. And you see, we want to think that Poland and Hungary are mean countries or have mean leaders. No, they are not. They are preserving their culture. And they are preserving their morals, their morality. They cannot afford Islamic moralities. They cannot also afford some, you know, some false Christian, you know, prophetic noise. They cannot afford that. So I think Poland and Hungary and Macedonia, their stance must be respected. Because one thing with being religious is that you lose that sense of self-evaluation. And you are 100% correct, everybody else is 100% wrong. And that is the problem. And that is what has plunged the Middle East into chaos. The Middle East is a most chaotic country, a place in the world, because of Islamic fanatism. It is a most chaotic country, it's a most chaotic place in the world. And people are fleeing, going to the countries of the kafirs. You know, the Arabs, say that whosoever is not a Muslim is a kafir. Now, a kafir means a useless pagan, non-believer, whatever it is. It's a bad word. But the people that are fleeing from Syria are not fleeing into Saudi Arabia where Islam started, or, you know, into Qatar. They are fleeing into kafir countries. Just like the white people say, you know, Africans are monkeys and all that, but then they are in monkey countries taking resources that belong to baboons. That type of fanatism is what brings chaos. And countries are saying no. So we cannot afford India and Pakistan to fight, and one of them plunges into chaos. We cannot afford that, because that is going to be problematic to, you know, the neighborhood. Those countries are the ones that are going to bear the brunt. Anyway, we will continue again next Sunday. And let me now hand over to my colleague who is in the north. And it is a great morning. Enjoy your Sunday and happy Kasinga Day. And of course, enjoy your holiday, those who are on holiday.
wana, waka wana, waka.